Thank you, Judge Easterbrook, and may it please the court. Despite the city's efforts to develop a fair and valid promotional exam for the fire lieutenant's position in 1986, when that exam was scored, minorities performed at only about a third of the rate of non-minorities, well below the presumptive illegality prescribed at 80% under Title VII. Faced with that gross disparity, the city concluded that use of the results in strict rank order would almost certainly have led to liability under Title VII in a case brought by minority firefighters. Accordingly, the city undertook the remedy approved by the Second Circuit in the Bushy case and standardized the scores by race. This morning, I will address the district court's...
When you refer to standardized, was this in the nature of differential validation? Or was it just a quota and then promotions from within the quota?
As I understand it, Your Honor, the scores were separated by race, kept in order by race, but...
So it was just a quota. It was not differential validation.
They were essentially separate lists, but they were in order as they had been on the unified list.
Right, but your answer to my technical question, did the city undertake differential validation, is no, I take it.
The city attempted to ascertain whether the results could be validated for use in strict rank order.
Differential validation is a technical term. Did the city do it? I mean, there's no mention of it in your brief.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I can attempt to ascertain that, but
we've
left my knowledge. This morning, I will address the district court's finding that the exam results were valid for use in strict rank order and a few aspects of the damages calculation. As for liability, under Croson, when there is a prima facie case of illegality, the employer is entitled to take voluntary affirmative action. In this case, the extent of the problem the city faced in terms of its exposure to Title VII liability is perhaps best illustrated by plaintiff's own expert, whom the district court credited. Dr. Goldman was able to identify the cause of only 40% of the gross disparity in scores between the minority and non-minority firefighters. That left a classic disparate impact case. Dr. Goldman did not even attempt to demonstrate that the list was valid for use in strict rank order. In fact, he did not offer any opinion on that issue. He merely criticized Mr. Joyce's conclusion that the list could not be validated for use in strict rank order. On this record, therefore, the district court's finding that the test results could be used in strict rank order and its conclusion in turn that the city had no basis to standardize the scores by race cannot stand. The finding of validity is clearly erroneous and should be set aside. As to the damages, let me begin with back pay. Like any other kind of damages, an award of back pay must be based on rational support in the evidence. In this case, there is simply no reasonable support for the probabilities that the jury found for the timing and probability of the plaintiff's promotions beyond lieutenant to captain and battalion chief.
When you went around the rank order, were there approximately 20 people upgraded and, well, I guess 19 downgraded? Is that a fair number? Is it the same number of those who the white candidates that were not chosen, even though they got higher grade, were they displaced by an equal number of minorities?
Yes, Your Honor.
So let's just work with the number 20, I guess, just round figures. Was it the bottom 20 that of the white group that was dropped down?
The
bottom 20 of those who passed, I guess.
Promotions were made over stages at different times. The city anticipated it would make about 300. We ended up making only about 200 because we took the list down after the 1991 Civil Rights Act was enacted. Those 200 promotions were not all made at the same time. The fire department would ascertain that it needed a certain number, and when those were needed, they were made off of the standardized list, which, and in the standardization, the process of standardization had the effect of elevating the scores of the minority test takers, and of course, correspondingly, lowering the non-minority firefighters on the list.
I mean, interrupt, just keeping my train of thought here. If the next group above, that was 20 who were white group, was there any determination of how well they did? Let's say the next 20 or 30 or 40, as opposed to those who were at the top of the list.
All of the tests after they were scored were ranked, and they were ranked, you know, in rank order on the promotional list.
And that's how, as promotions went in order of the rank order?
Promotions went in rank order of the standardized list. The list itself, when ranked.
But that's not Judge Mannion's question. He's asking a question that's identical to something I'm worried about. If you take the 20 whites immediately before our plaintiffs, people who were, in fact, promoted to lieutenants, how did they do, in fact, when they sought promotion to captain and battalion chief? Of that, of those 20, what percentage made captain, has made captain?
Of the plaintiffs here?
No, not of the plaintiffs. Of the people who were, in fact, promoted off this list before them. That is, the closest comparables.
I understand the question now, Your Honor. I actually do not believe that evidence it was presented.
But you see, that's the very best evidence about what the probability is that these people would have been promoted. And if it's not in the record, it's very difficult to say, gee, the jury must be wrong if it didn't have the best evidence of what it was that would be right.
Well, the evidence that is in the record is that when a number of these plaintiffs did take the captain's test, either in 92, some of them were promoted, although their promotions were delayed, they were promoted in time to take the 92 captain's exam. There were four who took that test, and only Mr. Timothy did well enough on that exam to be promoted off of it. There were three others, and we do set this out in our brief, but there were three others, Mr. Byrne, Mr. Gackie, mm-hmm. and Mr. Kolecki. They all yep. were promoted.
The problem is that four is a small number. We can get larger numbers and maybe get statistical significance by looking at the larger group of people who were the closest in the test but promoted to lieutenant at the same time.
Well, Your Honor, our position in this appeal is that it was the plaintiff's burden to separate themselves from the average test taker.
They did that by testifying that I am especially dedicated, and I read hard at home, and my family thinks well of me.
And
you may think that that's all twaddle, but the best way to combat twaddle is with data. And if it's just twaddle and nothing, there we are.
We credit it for what it's worth. It says that these plaintiffs studied hard, these plaintiffs wanted to be promoted, these plaintiffs were from firefighter families. Promotions were important to them, but not a single one of them testified that promotions were not important to the other candidates who vied for the captain's exam. There were 528...
Exactly. That's why you want to combat anecdotes with data.
So my question is, too, because I'm concerned about this, too, who's got the burden on this, the affirmative burden of showing what the percentages were and laying out those numbers, and what authority do you have to support whatever your response is?
The plaintiff always has the burden of supporting his damages award.
They did a pretty good job, whatever they did, based on what the jury did, and you're challenging that.
We are challenging it, Your Honor.
You challenge that by... with a different formula, saying this is crazy that all 20 of them would have done so well. And if you would compare that to the 20 just above the cutoff and show that only two or three of them made it, then maybe you'd have an argument that this other analysis was off base.
Well, there are a number of cases, both from this circuit and from other circuits, that clearly hold that when there are more candidates vying for promotions than the number of promotions that are available, the proper way to assess damages is to provide a pro rata share unless the plaintiff shows, carrying his burden of showing his damages, unless the plaintiff shows that he would have done better. Now, we absolutely accept that in a case like this, with dozens of candidates and hundreds of candidates and dozens of promotions, it's going to be more difficult. But for any plaintiff who finds it too difficult to separate himself from the other test takers, a pro rata share offers him a safe harbor. And that's what the cases hold.
Well, let me put it in a somewhat different way. The argument that we just look at the average is in many ways just a recap of the argument that this exam was not valid for use in rank order promotions, that is, that everybody is all the same. And that wasn't accepted on the merits half. It's not clear that it has to be accepted on the damages half of the case. Now, if that's accepted on the merits part of the case, you win outright. But if that view is not accepted on the merits part of the case, it's difficult to see why it must be accepted on the damages part of the case.
What must be accepted, Your Honor, we think, on the damages part of the case, is that any plaintiff who wants to walk away with more than an average has to show a greater than average probability.
Exactly. And all the plaintiffs show up and say, I'm from Lake Wobegon. This group is all better than average. And they manage to sell that to the jury, as indeed numerous students manage to sell it to their teachers, that they're all better than average.
Well, there certainly is some empirical
data.
We do have some data, Your Honor. We know that with few exceptions, all of the plaintiffs in this case ranked lower on the lieutenant's exam when they were not suffering from any emotional distress, they had not been passed over for promotion. What they did the best they could do on the lieutenant's test, and still, with very few exceptions, the plaintiffs here ranked in the bottom third or the bottom half of those of that test. So we start with that, and then we ask, what did they do to show that they were going to do better on the captain's test and what they or the battalion chief test? And what they attempted to show, to use to show that, was, I study hard, I cared about promotion, but of course, that didn't cut it at the lieutenant stage, so we know that much going in. Mm-hmm. Now, these plaintiffs attempt put on absolutely no evidence about any other test takers. They testified that they didn't know anything about the other test takers. And if the plaintiffs find it too difficult, as I say, to separate themselves from the average, then it seems to me that the average is appropriate. And, you know, I remarked a minute ago that obviously in a case like this, the numbers are harder than when there's, you know, eight promotions available and eight candidates and two promotions, for example, in the Doherty case from the D.C. Circuit. But the theory is the same, and the policy for providing merely a pro rata share unless the plaintiff carries his burden of showing that he is, in fact, better than average operates far more strongly in a case where the numbers of promotions are like this. It is extraordinary to devote to require the defendant to pay many, many, many times what it would have paid if it had not discriminated. And bear in mind here, the discrimination is, at best, our failure to appreciate that the plaintiffs might be able to carry their burden at trial years later of showing atypicality. There's no doubt that the results showed adverse impact. They showed rampant adverse impact. Success rates of a third instead of 80%. And that's what we looked at. And if we guessed wrong, we should pay back pay, but it should be rational. And these awards were not rational. And, of course, the front pay awards also fall if the back pay awards fall because they are tied to the same probability. As to emotional distress, I will close simply by noting that no court in the country, as far as either side has been able to identify, has ever upheld anything close to a six-figure award for plaintiffs who love their job, retain their job, insist they don't want to work anyplace else in spite of the adverse action taken against them in this case, and who are receiving back pay and some front pay. Those awards are excessive and should be remitted. I'll save the balance.
If this were a suit under the 1991 Act, what would the maximum compensatory award be against Chicago? Is Chicago subject to the $300,000 cap on compensatory awards?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'll have to get you that answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Friedman.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Linda Friedman, and along with my partner, Mary Stoll, we represent the plaintiff interveners and the class in this case. I would like to begin by answering some of the questions that have been asked regarding the damages and the data that was presented. The data that was presented to the jury was extensive concerning the subsequent promotional exams. The jury had each and every list for the subsequent promotional exams and had the ability to sit down in the jury room and compare the names from the 1986 lieutenant's exam to the names on the 1992 captain's exam and subsequent.
Comparing names as opposed to success rates was useful. To the extent I was able to do some quick study, it is that the people who were in slots 111 to 165 on the 1986 exam, all these people were promoted, who then took the captain's exam in 1992, succeeded 42% of the time. Now, these were people who scored better than your clients on the 1986 exam, and you'd expect them, therefore, to be, on average, score better than your clients on the 1992 exam. And yet, if they succeeded only 42% of the time, how can it possibly be that it's rational to find that almost all of your clients had 100% success probability? And this seems awfully hard to do.
I can answer that, Your Honor. First, I think that the jury also had the scores. And what the jury was able to see was that from the 1986 lieutenant's exam, that was an unusually talented group of people. And when you looked
and
at
therefore
the
it's the group of people your clients would have been competing against on the 1992 captain's exam.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if they were unusually talented, then your clients are lower in the ranking and have a lower probability of beating them out.
And I don't think that's accurate, because when you look at the list of the people who actually scored on the 1992 captain's exam, they did not maintain the same strict rank order. But what
sure.
was significant...
This is all probabilistic. That's why I really would have liked to see a good statistical analysis of this. But just using simple averages, some will do better, some will do worse. We have a 42% success rate of the people who beat out your clients on the 1986 test. And I don't see how, on average, your clients can do better than that group. Right? Individual clients will do better, but not on average. And yet this jury's award seems to reflect the view that your clients, on average, if you take out the people who got 0% ratings, would have had, say, an 80% success rate. And that seems to me simply impossible. It is not something that can happen in this world.
I think that if you look at an 80% success rate on the very first opportunity to become a captain and on the very first exam, then that's one issue. But what happened here is that the jury rated the probability of success based on the various promotions and the various promotional dates. So the time period was from 1992 all the way through 2000 and the time of the trial when the captain's awards were being given
offered
two different exams.
The 1992 captain's exam, what was the next one after that?
There was an exam in 1998. And there were
right.
a total of 250.
Do we know statistically what percentage of those not promoted from the 1992 list took the exam again in 1998 and were promoted from that list?
We do know that there were 250 people who were promoted to captain between the time of the 1992 exam and the date of the trial, approximately 250 people. And of those people, the overwhelming majority of the original...
That's not my question. Of those people who took the 1992 exam and were not promoted, what percentage of that group took the 1998 exam and have been promoted?
The jury had that information. I do not have that statistic in front of me right now.
If we have that data in the record, I would appreciate it if either side would provide it in a short letter after argument. Anyway, please proceed.
Thank you. Looking at the pool of people who took the 1986 exam and comparing them to the test takers who were promoted to captain, it is clear from the 1992 exam that the overwhelming majority of those who were promoted from that exam came from the 1986 lieutenant's exam.
Of course, aside from the statistics, the jury didn't have before them any of the characteristics or qualifications of the other candidates.
The jury had in front of them the knowledge, skills, and abilities required for the job, and also had a number of different people who came in who testified who were promoted from that list and who sat for that exam and were not promoted from that list. So the jury was able to compare. The jury, for example, learned that Michael Callahan was one of the people who took the exam who scored very high on the exam, even though he had not scored as high on the lieutenant's exam. So they were able to understand that group of people who took the 86 exam fared very well on subsequent exams.
But, I mean, they didn't have any...
Yeah, 42%
data
of them.
Right. And they didn't know about the particular characteristics, even of those 42%, in terms of their achievements, in terms of awards, in terms of their performance in the field. None of that data was available, right?
Right.
As to that 42% group. So when the jury was to compare, you know, if they looked at your clients, aside from their desire to be promoted and their love of the police department and family tradition and all these things, in terms of characteristics, I'm talking about job performance, the jury didn't have that specific data. Right?
That's correct. In terms of
this strikes me as like asking a jury to determine what the likelihood that an associate would be promoted to partner at a law firm is, looking only at the claim that the associate had a great college education, did well in law school, without looking at the rivals who did make partner. If you don't look at the other people, then you've got to have good data about how people who graduated from law school X and went into, White and Case, to name an enormous law firm, did when the time came for promotion. And if you don't look at how comparables actually did, and you don't look at what the rivals' qualities are, I don't see how you can get an accurate conclusion.
And maybe I'm not making myself clear, but I think the
even if each of these people said, I read law extensively every night, I read the daily law bulletin, it wouldn't tell you what their probability of promotion to partner was.
I think the difficulty with approaching it in that manner is that for the 1992 exam for captain, there were two different groups of people who sat for that exam. One group of people were people who came from the 1986 lieutenant's exam, and the other group of people came from a prior exam, had been repeat test takers, and had not made it to captain in prior attempts. So it is not clear how the 42% would have been 42% if our clients had been included in the mix, because our clients, the 40, and I think the number was 20, but it's actually 40, our 40 clients may well have beat out the people who had been the repeat test takers and may have increased the overall average of the 1986 test takers. What is clear is that the repeat test takers and those from the 78 lieutenant's exam did not fare as well as those from the 1986 lieutenant's exam. And it's also clear that not all of the people from the 1986 exam sat for the captain's exam. So of those who were promoted to lieutenant and sat for the exam, they did do extremely well. I'd like to move on to another point, which was your question, Judge Easterbrook, regarding the quota. Is the plaintiff intervener's position that this was a quota that was imposed on the 1986 list? The list was standardized by race, and the promotions were made within race by strict order. There was no ban, and there was no attempt to make sure that in the different promotional rounds that the people who were promoted were statistically equivalent or within any SEM. Instead, the scores were ranked, and some people dropped as many as over 100 ranks on the promotional list. So that is one of the reasons why Judge Holderman found pretextual the city's assertion that it the exam was not valid for strict rank order use, and that is because, in fact, the city did use the exam within strict rank order when it went to make the promotions.
Well, now, you certainly had the burden of proving that the exam was valid for rank order promotions, right, as a plaintiff?
That's an interesting question, and I think that it's fair to say that we had the overall burden of proving the unconstitutionality of the city's remedial action. However, the question of who had the burden on strict rank order is really answered by looking at where you begin the analysis. If you begin the analysis and you ask the question, did the plaintiffs prove that their rights were violated in terms of a prima facie case? They did. It was stipulated that there was intentional discrimination in, with respect to the race norming of the list. Then the burden would shift to the city to show that it had a strong basis in evidence for the action that it took. In this case, the city relied in part on the four-fifths rule, which is the 80% rule, but it also stipulated that the exam was job-related and validated, content valid.
Right, and then the burden shifts back to you, so then ultimately, don't you still have to prove that the exam was valid for rank order promotions?
I believe that we did meet that burden, but what I would say is that to the extent that it is the city's burden to show that it had a strong basis in evidence, the city eliminated the strong basis in evidence that was created by the differential scores when it stipulated that the test was valid for strict rank order. Therefore, the city's strong basis in evidence would have to shift to the analysis of whether or not the test was valid for strict rank order, and the city would have to establish that it had a strong basis in evidence for believing that the test was not sufficient to be used in strict rank order, or not valid for strict rank order use. I do think that we ultimately sustained the burden and were given the burden of proving that it was valid for strict rank order, and for all the same reasons that the jury found that the test was not discriminatory, the jury and the judge found that the exam was valid for strict rank order. And those reasons include many of the same reasons that were set forth by this court in the Bryant case.
Well, let me just follow this line. What evidence is there in the record that a person who scored higher on the test is likely to perform the job better than one who scored lower?
There are many pieces of evidence. First, the evidence is that the jury found that the exam was a non-discriminatory exam. And that was based on the efforts, and I think this court in Bryant...
I just want to get this specific question answered. What's evidence that a person who scored higher on the test is likely to perform the job better than one who scored lower?
The city stipulated that the exam was job-related and content-valid. The Cooter-Richardson score, in terms of its validity, was 0.9. That score was reached before the city made adjustments, including double-keying, triple-keying, eliminating questions, and also standardizing the test by week. So it is reasonable to infer that the Cooter-Richardson score was even higher than 0.9. The standard SEM was 3.4 to 3.5, but that too was calculated when the exam was on two different weeks and the exam was given on a whole number scoring system. So the scores ranged from 96 to 27. When they shifted from 100 to 48 and were carried out to thousands, it was reasonable for the jury and the court to assume that the SEM would have also decreased by from the 3.4 to an even narrower range. And in fact, Judge Holderman found Dr. Goldman's testimony on this point credible and persuasive regarding what would have happened to the SEM and what would have happened to the Cooter-Richardson. So I believe the answer to your question is that the Cooter-Richardson of a score of 0.9 is a good score and an acceptable score for the City of Chicago Fire Test and within the industry. It was reasonable for the court to assume that that score was even higher because that score had not been calculated after steps had been taken to increase the reliability on the exam.
So there was no witness, though, that really testified that a person who scored higher on the test is likely to perform the job better than one who scored lower, and the court didn't make such a specific finding, did it?
The court found that the exam was valid for strict rank order use based on the testimony relating to the development, administration, and oversight of the exam, and also related to the SEM and Cooter-Richardson, which are recognized as the basis for determining that a test is valid by strict rank order. In the Guardian's case in the Second Circuit, those were the two items that the court pointed to as being missing, the Cooter-Richardson score and the points by serial correlation, to make certain that the people who did better on the exam were in fact related to the questions that they answered or didn't answer.
I have one other question related to the district court's finding. The court found that the exam did not discriminate against minorities. How do we know that the reason for this statement couldn't be that there was adverse impact, but the exam was valid for rank order use. I mean, in terms of the court reaching the rank order use, why would the court even get to that if the court hadn't found that there was adverse impact or hadn't agreed with the city's conclusion?
I'm glad you asked that question because I was going to begin there. The answer to your question is that the parties, after 12 years of litigation, stipulated to try the case by presenting an interrogatory to the jury asking whether or not the test discriminated against minorities. It was abundantly clear that there were two different positions. The city's position was that based on the 80% rule that the city established a prima facie case, and the city's position was that the test was not valid for strict rank order. In the very few early pages of the trial, the city confirms that and explains to the judge whether the city can adjust the results depends upon whether the test in fact discriminated, and the city explained what it meant when it would find that it did not discriminate. That would be that it was not valid for strict rank order or there was a disparate impact. The plaintiffs, on the other hand, set forth their case very clearly. Their case was that the exam had atypicality and there was no adverse impact. Judge Holderman, in his decision, found the following. Found that the expert offered by the plaintiff, Dr. Goldman, solely on the issue of atypicality, was credible and persuasive on all points, and found that the expert offered by the city to refute the atypicality was not credible and not persuasive. The judge also found...
Does it mean to say he was not credible? That is, that he didn't actually believe the report he had given to the judge?
Yes.
Is that plausible?
Yes, because there was a opportunity in his cross-examination to show that what Dr. Korish was actually doing was rendering a result that would be one that would be used by the city in the litigation, but not one that was particularly sensical. And that had to do with a grouping analysis that he put together. He made the argument that if all people lack the qualities, then they will all be the same. So if six people didn't have any of the characteristics relating to atypicality, then their scores ought to be the same.
I can understand the argument. It's common in cases involving experts that a particular review is bad social science. I don't understand the proposition that he didn't even believe the numbers or something like that. Right? There's a